Graham Young was a psychopath.
Graham Young was more dangerous than the craze. No one could trust him.
It didn't matter who his victims were, whether they were his family, workmates, school friends, they were just guinea pigs to him.
An interest in poisons and fascination with the Nazis. It was a murderous combination.
Graham Young was a man with a passion for poison. But far from experimenting in laboratories, he carried out his deadly trials on family, friends and work colleagues, murdering three of them. How did this gifted chemist transform himself into the man they called the teacup poisoner? I'm Fred Dynage, and I've been reporting on serious crime as a journalist and television reporter for more than 40 years. As the official biographer to the Cray twins, I know that when it comes to crime, the myth can take over from the reality of what actually happened. I want to know what made Graham Young so very different from other boys in the 1950s. Brought up in Neasden in London, he said he'd suffered a troubled childhood. This led him to embark on a campaign of poisoning unlike any other in British history. For my investigation into Graham Young, I'm going to meet the people who came face to face with the poisoner and survived. I'll also be speaking with the individuals who've examined the motives behind his murderous reign. I always want to try and take a psychological perspective into what transforms a person into a killer. Who better to do that than top criminologist David Wilson?
Well, Graham Young didn't have the easiest starts in life. His mother died 12 weeks after the birth, which meant that Young's father fostered him out to an aunt. Now, even being fostered out to a family member wasn't particularly a successful event in Young's background. His aunt didn't particularly bond with him. Eventually, his father remarries and the stepmother brings the family back together. But Young and the stepmother were almost at loggerheads immediately. So this was a boy who didn't have the easiest of family circumstances, seemed to bear some antagonism towards his stepmother. And of course, that was going to have deadly consequences in the future.
From a very early age, Young fostered interests in taboo subject matters. He was fascinated with the Nazis. He openly read Mein Kampf and spoke about the virtues of Hitler, only 14 years after the Second World War ended. The story of Graham Young is indeed fascinating. Anthony Holden was a young reporter on the case and wrote a book called The St. Albans Poisoner. I'm hoping he can tell me what motivated this sadistic killer.
Graham Young, who was born same year as me, 1947, was, as a child, clearly very, very clever boy, very interested in science and history, and he kept voluminous notebooks and was really educating himself into being an extremely expert chemist. It's just unfortunate that the chemistry he was interested in was poisonous.
As a child, Graham Young received a present from his father, Fred, and stepmother, Molly, for passing his 11+. It was a chemistry set. Nobody could have known that such a present would become a catalyst for Young's reign of terror and inspire him to learn about his first deadly poison, antimony.
Here we've got a boy who, almost from the start, is isolated, is lonely, is obsessed with poisons, and crucially, is obsessed with Nazism. It was almost as if the writing was on the wall for Graham Young from a very early age.
At school, Graham Young didn't make many friends. The one he did make soon regretted becoming pals with the poisoner.
So he had a girlfriend called Chris Williams, who he really liked. And they would have sandwiches together, never have sandwiches with Graham Young. He'd slip some antimony into his friend's sandwich. Williams would be off school for a few days with some mystery virus. The doctors would say it was a virus or a bug. And he'd just make notes, and although this was supposedly his best friend.
And indeed, on one occasion, Christopher had been off school for so long that Young and he went off to London Zoo for the day. And Eva Young, the helpful psychopath, says to Christopher, "Well, look, I know you've been ill. I've managed to get some lemonade that should be able to help cure you." In fact, that lemonade simply included more antimony. Young's psychopathy knew no end. He simply wanted to be near people that he could do harm to. And Christopher Williams was a very lucky young man in that he didn't have to go home with Young every single night and eat food with him, as Young's parents and sister did.
At home, 13-year-old Young was conducting a more long-term experiment upon his family.
So he'd put some poison in the Sunday joint, not eat that bit himself. Watch what it did to his father, his stepmother, his sister, and make notes. So if stepmum, as she did, threw up after lunch, he'd say 2 grams makes her throw up.
The family suspected the enthusiastic chemist was to blame for their sickness. They believed he'd accidentally contaminated kitchen utensils he'd borrowed to carry out his school experiments. Little did they know their son was using them as human guinea pigs, and that his experiments were inspired by Britain's most popular crime author.
In 1961, Sir Graham would have been 14 during his first bout of poisonings. Agatha Christie published a novel called The Pale Horse, in which the poison that's used is this poison thallium. There's a very detailed technical quote in the Agatha Christie novel about thallium and its effects, which clearly was to him like reading a textbook.
My investigations have revealed that antimony and thallium aren't chemicals that can be easily purchased. I want to learn more about the poisons Young was using and the impact they could have if they were used on a human. A man who's agreed to help me is forensic scientist James Cleary.
Antimony is a very hard, brittle sort of metalloid, and it can be very easily powdered. So if you imagine, you know, most people think of metal as very hard substances, you know, it's going to be hard to absorb into the body. Whereas if you put that into very fine powder form, it can be very easily and very readily absorbed into the body. And once it's in the body, the problem with heavy metals is that they cannot be destroyed or broken down. And once it actually ends up in the tissue, it become locked, and it's actually very hard to get rid of it.
So, James, what would be the effects then on a human being, on a body?
You end up with effects that might be distinguished as, say, a viral poisoning, like influenza. So you have, like, tummy upsets, sort of headaches, sweating, fever, that type of effect on an individual. As time goes on, one of the obvious effects is hair loss. So that's one big effect that you'll find with chronic poisoning, but usually if it's an acute poisoning, the effects are so strong and so quick that you sort of really die before you get the hair loss.
Bouts of sickness had become increasingly more common in the Young household, and the teenage poisoner had set his sights on one family member in particular.
Within his family, he's particularly going to concentrate on Molly, his stepmother. This is the stepmother he's hated from the age of 3. This is the stepmother who destroys his toy aeroplane collection. This is the stepmother whom he gives small doses of antimony to over a long period of time, some 12 months, so as to replicate the symptoms of gastroenteritis. So Molly's constantly in bad health with stomach problems.
So he took enormous pleasure then in watching his stepmother in agony dying.
And of course, you're right. He's going to be sitting across the breakfast table, the lunch table, the dinner table, knowing full well that he's given his stepmother Molly a dose of antimony that's going to cause her major stomach problems. He's going to take pleasure out of the power that he knows that she's going to have an unpleasant evening, an unpleasant day. It's the sense in which he can control this environment that's interesting to me, because psychologically I think that's what he's been desperate for all his life. He's been desperate to have power and control over circumstances that he feels he has no power and control over. Through poisoning his family, he is able to establish that control.
The levels of sickness were becoming increasingly violent. On the evening of April the 21st, 1962, Graham's father, Fred, returned home to find his wife, Molly, writhing in agony in their garden. comforting her, Fred spied a figure gazing down on them. It was Graham. He was motionless. It was as if he was watching an experiment.
Molly was admitted to hospital, but her symptoms mystified the doctors.
She told the staff that she just wanted to go home to make her family dinner. They were her last words.
Just hours later, Molly Young was dead.
The post-mortem stated that her cause of death was due to a collapsed bone at the top of her spinal column that she'd suffered a year earlier. They had no reason to suspect antimony.
Graham Young had claimed his first life and got away with it. He was now on the lookout for his next unsuspecting victim for his deadly experiments. I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm looking into the crimes committed by the teacup poisoner, Graham Young. I want to know whether he was a misguided genius or a calculated killer.
In 1962, Graham Young's stepmother, Molly, had died in mysterious circumstances. Doctors believed her painful death was related to an old car injury she'd suffered. The true cause was much closer to home. She'd been poisoned by 14-year-old Graham Young.
Graham Young never showed any sign of remorse, not just about killing his stepmother, who he may have had some objections to, but his own father, Fred, was permanently damaged, his liver, etc., by the poison that Graham fed to him. His sister, Winifred, was damaged. These were people who had been nice to him and friendly to him and paternal or sisterly. The last people you'd think he would go after, but they were just the nearest to hand.
With his stepmother dead, Graham Young began placing larger doses of antimony in his father's food and drink. Today, antimony is only possible to access with a government license. In the 1960s, it was mainly used in the manufacturing of batteries and solder. The chemical was only available to pharmacists and industry experts. Even though he was only 14, Graham Young had no problem acquiring large amounts for his deadly experiments.
He was a boy who could clearly switch on the charm when the occasion demanded. He was going into chemists asking to get access to a certain number of poisons. He would explain that away by explaining that he was doing experiments at school. Indeed, on one occasion, he would say that he was at university. Crucially, he would always sign the poisons register that the chemist demanded. Graham Young could appear mature and competent and adult, clearly masking his murderous intent behind gaining access to these poisons.
Would it be a painful death?
Essentially what it's doing is destroying the nerve endings, and one of the effects of that is that you end up with numbness in the fingers, and of note with antimony is the effect of walking on hot coals. I think, yes, it would have been a very painful death.
Months had passed since his stepmother's death. His father, Fred Young, was still in mourning when he too began suffering severe bouts of sickness. He was rushed to hospital, where the doctors were keen to monitor his condition, but they weren't the only ones. As with his stepmother, Graham had kept meticulous notes on his father's slow demise. In hospital, he sat quietly watching the effects. The doctors suspected that Fred was suffering from some form of poisoning. They couldn't agree on whether arsenic or antimony was responsible. When Graham began to lecture them on how to distinguish between the two, his father demanded they get that boy away from me. Fred Young had become suspicious of his son. He wasn't the only one.
When he's at school, he's useless in virtually every other subject except for chemistry. The chemistry teacher becomes suspicious. Other family members are suspicious of this these continuing health problems in Young's family. And so the chemistry teacher finds poisons in his desk, calls the family doctor. The family doctor calls in a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist and the police interview Young on the pretext that his knowledge of chemistry is so great. Perhaps he's already at university level. Young, of course, revealing the true nature of the psychopath, the true nature of the serial killer, is desperate for the attention and, of course, shows off. His arrogance knows no bounds.
Young's bravado left the police in no doubt that he was responsible for the series of illnesses at home and school. They arrested him for attempted murder.
Young had, even at that young age, he was only 14, had in his pocket what he called his exit dose. He had a phial of poison for himself in case this happened, but unfortunately he never had time to get to it. Well, unfortunately for him and for his subsequent victims.
Young confessed to poisoning his sister Winifred, friend Chris Williams, and his father Fred through the food, milk, and water at home. His stepmother's body had been cremated, so Young could not be charged with her murder.
He was convicted of poisoning sundry people, and the judge at the time decided, because of his youth, he was only 14, that the best thing was to send him to a mental hospital for the criminally insane.
At just 14, he was sentenced to serve 15 years at Broadmoor, becoming the youngest ever person to be committed to the psychiatric hospital since 1885. Both Ronnie Cray and the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, have been inmates at Britain's most renowned psychiatric hospital. One man who knows of Broadmoor's reputation is former criminal Bobby Cummins. Bobby now runs a charity that helps ex-offenders called Unlock. Although he was never sent to Broadmoor, he did serve time in later years with Graham Young.
There was always that weariness if you had the Broadmoor label on you. Two types go to Broadmoor, those who are working their ticket and don't want to do our jail, so they want to get into the mental health system where it's a lot easier. And there's those that are in Broadmoor that are completely off the road, completely bonkers, that will kill you.
Broadmoor gave Young the opportunity to further his learning. He had access to their library, and despite being a high-risk prisoner, the authorities didn't restrict the types of books he read.
And he was in Broadmoor, which means he didn't come under the prison system where he was restricted on, you know, and watched on what he read. He could go to the library. But most of the books that guy would be reading would be on poisons and toxicology, that sort of thing, you know. He wouldn't be reading Mrs. Beaton's cookery book unless it was something to do with, can I put a poison in the cake, you know, that sort of thing, you know.
He's only 14, 15 when he first goes to Broadmoor. The authorities at the time wouldn't imagine that they were dealing with a psychopath of the kind that Young was. They would simply have seen him as a troubled boy.
Even the strict confines of the secure hospital weren't enough to deter Young from trying to achieve a lifelong ambition of infamy.
He would occasionally put Harpic or sugar soap, whatever unpleasant, if not poisonous, semi-poisonous materials were to hand in an institution like that, into the tea urn that went around Broadmoor, and there were reports of illnesses.
Another patient, John Berridge, died from cyanide poisoning only months after arriving at Broadmoor. Young claimed to have produced the poison, extracting it from laurel bushes on the hospital grounds. His confession was not taken seriously, and the death was recorded as suicide.
So he continues to demonstrate this type of behaviour, but crucially, he then recognises he has this ability to turn the charm on again, to appear mature, to appear adult. He crucially recognises that if he ever wants to get out of Broadmoor, he's got to convince the authorities, Dr. Udwin, his personal psychiatrist, that he's safe to release. And so Young gradually changes that behaviour and appears as the model prisoner, the model patient.
In the 1960s, Broadmoor was undergoing the transition from an old-style penal institution to a modern psychiatric hospital. The man in charge of the poisoner's rehabilitation was Dr. Edgar Udwin. He was responsible for determining just how dangerous Young was and whether he should be released back into the community.
There's an arrogance with psychiatrists. They always think they're inside your mind. I once had a psychiatrist say to me, how do I get inside a prisoner's mind? And I said, make sure he don't get in your mind. If you hold the keys to my release, I'm not going to tell you the truth. I'm going to tell you what benefits me.
Professor David Wilson is a former prison governor. He's been responsible for some of Britain's toughest prisoners. You've had a lot of experience as a prison governor. Is it possible for prisoners, for inmates to con doctors and psychiatrists?
Yes, of course it's possible, because doctors and psychiatrists and prison governors are human. Humans make mistakes. Therefore, you've got to be very careful indeed about the decision-making process that's going to put somebody who's committed very grave offences back into the community.
Young, to me, must have been so clearly a malevolent presence, malevolent force, that it does surprise me that a sophisticated psychiatrist in an institution like that, full of baddies, could be persuaded by this young boy. But Graham was very clever, and he was obviously quite a good actor as well.
8 years into his sentence, Young had seemingly transformed from a sadistic poisoner into a remorseful young man. Dr. Udwin believed he was making good progress.
Udwin did a report to the Home Secretary, whose responsibility it was, Reginald Maudling at that time, saying this boy is still only just 20, early 20s. They reckoned once you've been in there 10 years, you're institutionalized, you're never going to be able to cope with the outside world again.
In 1970, Graham Young had served 8 years for poisoning his father. Dr. Udwin wrote to the Board of Governors and told them he believed Graham Young was fit to return to society and was granted home visits.
He thought, we'll take one experiment, and he said to Graham, I'm going to let you out for a week. You can go and stay with your sister, Winifred, and see how it goes, see how you cope with the outside world. And he wrote her a letter that subsequently became famous, because he said, guess what, your friendly neighbourhood Frankenstein is coming to stay with you next week. And he did go and stay with them for a week. She had a husband, a small child, and a dog, who all of whom you'd think in the context of this story might have a little strychnine in the dog food. But no, Graham knew that this was his key to getting out and behaved like a model patient.
There are several parts of Dr. Udwin's behaviour in releasing Young that I find extraordinary. But I would also say there's a context. Young has gone to Broadmoor not as a convicted murderer. He's gone to Broadmoor as a 14-year-old boy who attempted to poison his father, his sister, and a school friend. Now, that's a very different set of criminogenic factors from somebody who had been sent to prison for murder. So I think Dr. Udwin is trying to help this boy back into the community.
By 1971, Graham Young walked out of the gates of Broadmoor a rehabilitated man. Or that's what he'd made the authorities believe. I'm Fred Dinage, and I'm investigating the case of Graham Young, the teacup poisoner. In 1971, he was freed from Broadmoor, where he'd served 8.5 years for poisoning his father. As far as the authorities were concerned, he was cured. Graham Young was only 23 and had made it clear he wanted to start a new life. He set out to find a job, one where he could put his chemistry skills to good use.
He was trained as a storeman by the Broadmoor Release Service. The next astonishing irony of this story is the poison that Graham was by now interested in was called thallium, which is a heavy metal poison. And its main industrial use is in photography. There are two companies in this country that stock thallium in the manufacture photographic lenses. And the Broadmoor Placement Service found Graham Young a job in one of these two factories, a place called Hadlands Laboratories in a little village called Bovingdon, just outside Hemel Hempstead.
A government training scheme provided Graham Young with a glowing reference. Hadlands employed almost 100 people. Anthony Odom was one of them back in the 1970s. He remembers Graham Young. This is the first time he's ever agreed to speak about him and the devastation he caused. What do you remember then of Graham Young?
Well, when Graham arrived, it was understood that he'd come from some sort of rehabilitation as a result of a mental breakdown. He didn't strike one as being exceptional. He was very dark, somewhat glum, very articulate, clearly very intelligent, And he obviously conveyed through one means or another his knowledge of chemistry. And we, those that were curious, asked him what he'd been and what he'd done in the past. And he said, well, I was actually a failed chemistry student or a failed pharmacist. So when those terms, any sort of medically related or chemistry terms were used, it didn't come as a great surprise because that's what we believed him to have been. I do remember colleagues saying to me one day, as we were discussing him generally, just don't get him on the subject of Hitler and the Nazis because it's a favourite topic and he'll be off on one, basically, and it's we did smile about it and say, yes, OK, we'll clear of that.
Young thought his job would entail working with the deadly chemical thallium. To his disappointment, it wasn't kept on site. Once used as a rat poison, thallium should have been impossible to purchase. But again, Young persuaded a chemist to provide him with large quantities of the poisonous metal.
Thallium, it's a very soft, malleable metal, and actually that metal is actually very easily and readily dissolved in water. And it's odourless, colourless and tasteless, which means that if you had it in a drink, you wouldn't even suspect it was there.
Graham Young hadn't changed and now had new friends to target.
People were taking time off, either 1 or 2 days or whatever, and then things started to get more serious. Just within a very small group of people, but there was just a few that you thought, not a nice thing, not a nice complaint. There was a particular occasion, I remember, when I was in one of the buildings and looking out and somebody came rushing out of the stores and was violently ill on the grass outside, which, looking back on it, well, at the time we thought, there's something very extraordinary going on there.
Bob Eagle was to become Young's first victim at Hadlands. He complained of chronic stomach pains and a numbing sensation in his body. Over a period of 2 months, Bob Eagle was regularly admitted to hospital. Each time, doctors failed to diagnose his problem and he returned to work, where he confided his ailments to his colleague, Graham Young.
Bob Eagle was very ill. I think it was probably the thallium had a very horrible effect on him in terms of the sensitivity of his skin. It was giving him violent hallucinations. He was, in effect, having nightmares out of hell with this.
Thallium poisoning is not a pleasant way to die. And of course, as we would later discover, Saddam Hussein uses exactly the same type of poison when he's trying to bump off political opponents in Iraq.
Agatha Christie says it's the sort of the poisonous drug of choice, that it is so hard to detect. In terms of suspicion, you wouldn't suspect it as being, you know, someone suffering from thallium poisoning in normal day-to-day sort of life. And then once it actually, you then start to suffer from these symptoms and these sort of illnesses and diarrhea and upset stomach, it's very hard to be very prescriptive in terms of knowing exactly what the cause of it was. And I'm sure most medical doctors say it would be quite hard to push to be able to determine exactly what the cause was until it got to the stage where it's too late. There is actually something with thallium called Prussian blue that you can use as a bit of an antidote, and it binds with the thallium to stop it going into the soft tissue. But once it does go into the tissue, then it essentially becomes locked. It essentially becomes a bioaccumulator. It kind of sticks into your tissue and very hard to remove. And I think at that stage, once you're at that level of sort of poisoning, then there's very little you can do about it. I think literally you're just waiting to die.
Bob Eagle's condition worsened and he returned to hospital. Every treatment they tried was unsuccessful, and his condition grew worse by the day. 8 days after being admitted, Bob Eagle died. Bob Eagle's death was recorded as bronchopneumonia with Guillain-Barré polyneuritis, a rare disease of the immune system. Poison wasn't suspected.
Bob Eagle was cremated, and in fact it was Graham who went round to see the widow and explained to her that cremation was probably the best option these days. And as fate would have it, Hadland, the managing director, chose Graham Young to accompany him to the funeral on behalf of the company, because he'd been Bob Eagle's friend. So Graham sat in the crematorium watching the evidence of his crime literally go up in smoke.
As no one suspected Young was the culprit, he was free to continue his reign of poisoning.
He targeted at least 10 of his nearest colleagues, each was struck down with the same mysterious symptoms and had to spend time off work. Only 2 months after Bob Eagle's murder, the poisoner turned his attention towards Fred Biggs. Fred Biggs, the store manager, had worked at Hadlands for 4 years. He made the fatal mistake of befriending Young. He too began to suffer chronic pain and sickness. On the 19th of November 1971, Fred Biggs became the second person to die of what the staff at Hadlands believed to be a mysterious bug.
Why he chooses particular targets doesn't seem to me to be particularly clear. For example, he targeted one man whom he knew was going to leave the job. In fact, Young got the job because this chap was going to work in another factory. So sometimes his motivation isn't clear, because at the end of the day, Fred, we're dealing with a psychopath. You know, they don't think rationally sometimes. But if we see the bulk of his targets as being his stepmother, his father, his sister, his school friend, it's people who are close to him, people over whom he would like power and control, a power and control that I think he felt had been denied to him.
Graham Young made meticulous notes detailing the effects that the poison had upon his victims.
I think it's quite sick, as he's actually still working with them. He's still their colleague, and you know, working with them and presumably talking about sort of things as people do, and observing them and getting ill and continuing to dose them up, and having that observational sort of element, I think, is the bit that I find hard to understand, the cold level of removal of dosing them up and then just sitting back and watching them suffer.
The management at Hadlands were impelled to call in a doctor to investigate the cause of the two deaths and the serious illness. They also wanted to reassure the workforce.
So the doctor went on, having described this business of the analysis and so forth they'd been doing, and he came to the conclusion that we were probably suffering from some sort of hybrid flu virus, and that these things were very aggressive, and that was probably what the situation was.
In amongst the concerned staff, one man stood out from the crowd.
Graham Young then piped up and started asking questions. And there were very technical terms that he was using. I suppose in a sense we weren't so surprised because of this past experience that we thought he had.
Here's the arrogant psychopath once again emerging to the fore, as he had done when the psychiatrist comes into school to interview him. Young says too much. He reveals this knowledge of poisons. Indeed, he suggests to the authorities, have you considered thallium poisoning? And it's that over eagerness to be part of the story, to be at the forefront of what's happening, that leads to Young being arrested.
In November 1971, the police were called in to investigate Young. A check of his criminal record revealed his past conviction as a poisoner. When the police raided Graham Young's room, they found the walls decorated with Nazi artifacts, each surface filled with an array of chemicals. More importantly, they discovered his handwritten diary, detailing every dose of poison he'd administered to his unsuspecting victims and the impact it had on them. New tests were carried out on the internal organs of Fred Biggs and the ashes of Bob Eagle. The results were shocking. It was estimated that over time, Biggs had ingested more than 100 grams of thallium. Just 1 gram could be fatal.
You know, we were a close group, very trusting and understanding of each other. And suddenly you have this situation where somebody has been very, very malicious. Within a group like that, it has a pretty profound effect on everybody. But horror, really, I suppose is the only way you can describe it.
Less than a year after leaving Broadmoor, Graham Young was rearrested. At the factory, he'd claimed 2 lives and made many others seriously ill. His scientific abilities knew no bounds. His new laboratory was now to be Britain's toughest prison. I'm Fred Dynage, and I'm examining the life of Graham Young, the teacup poisoner. His knowledge of poisons was so advanced, many believe he could have become one of Britain's leading experts in this field. Instead, however, he chose to devote his talents to killing at least three people and poisoning many others.
In 1972, Young had been arrested for killing his work colleagues, Fred Biggs and Bob Eagle. On the 19th of June, Graham Young's trial began in St Albans. He pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. Anthony Holden was sent to cover the story for the local paper, and his articles caught the attention of the poisoner.
It was the first time I laid eyes on him, and it was a pretty scary sight. He was in court, his demeanour was very arrogant, detached, like one of those dictators who doesn't recognise the court, you know. He sent me notes across the court that said, can you make me so famous that I wind up in the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussauds? I want to go down in history as a really famous murderer.
The defence called just one witness, the accused, Graham Young. He remained cool under questioning. His arrogance never wavered. He disagreed with the medical evidence presented by the prosecution. Young insisted the deaths were due to a virus.
The irony of the whole trial was that we journalists knew about poisoning his family when he was a teenager, 8 years in Broadmoor. Obviously the jury and did not know about that, because you're not allowed to raise previous convictions during a trial. And we would often be in the canteen drinking a cup of tea with the jury. It was so tempting in that absurd way to go across and say, hey, do you know he's done it before? Because you can never tell during a trial what impression the evidence is making on the jury.
The prosecution's key evidence was Young's diary. He'd kept a record of every measure of poison he'd dispensed to his co-workers at the factory.
His study of Fred Biggs was shocking. I have administered a fatal dose of the special compound. He is surviving too long for my peace of mind. It took only a short amount of time for the jury to reach its verdict.
Young was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment for each murder. Asked if he felt remorse for his actions, Young said, "What I feel is the emptiness of my soul."
Not until after the verdict, after they found him guilty, was it revealed that he'd done this before. And then, of course, there was this huge national scandal.
He should never have been let out of Broadmoor in the first place. I accept that he manipulated and was clever there. The management was certainly not made aware of his complete background. Had they been, then I think they would have picked up the situation much quicker and realised that there was something amiss. And thirdly, he should never have had access to the chemicals that he did.
Young's ability to access deadly poison and Broadmoor's failure to warn his employers were serious issues that needed to be addressed if such a tragedy was to be avoided again.
Crucially now, we'd have something called the MAPA arrangements, the Multi-Agency Public Protection Arrangements, which follow the career of a newly released prisoner who's regarded as still potentially dangerous, who follow his career in the community, checking out on a regular basis that he isn't engaging in risky behaviour that would do other people harm.
The jury raised concerns in their summary about Young's ability to get hold of deadly poisons so easily.
1972 is when the Poisons Act changed in terms of access to these type of many types of poisons, including heavy metals. And it's interesting to note that the jury on the second trial from him poisoning his co-workers, they actually fed back to the court saying that one issue they had was the access to these poisons, that it was just so easy, and obviously that they felt that it should change. And within a few months after that, the Poisons Act changed, and that meant that it was actually much harder to get hold of these poisons.
Young's previous conviction had sent him to Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital. This time, he was sent to Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight, home to some of Britain's toughest criminals.
He decides he doesn't want to go back to Broadmoor, but would rather go into the mainstream penal estate. So he's locked up in Parkhurst, where guess who befriends him? Ian Brady, one of the Moors murderers. Brady also somebody who is obsessed with Nazism, and they have an immediate connection with each other because both have this fascination for Hitler, for the Third Reich, and for Nazi insignia. But interestingly, Brady describes him as looking like a young Joseph Goebbels. And so here we've got this direct link back into this boyhood obsession, poison, and Nazis still emerging all these years later in Parkhurst.
Whereas Brady was happy to spend time with the poisoner, the majority of prisoners weren't. Bobby Cummins was one of 500 inmates who avoided him.
Bobby, you've actually met him. What sort of bloke was he?
Well, let's put it this way, Fred. You know, we're sitting here having a cup of tea. I think we'd not be picking up those cups if we had Graham in our company and know that he poured it. I wouldn't even say you drink it first to see whether it was all right, because the chances are he would know exactly how much to drink that wouldn't hurt him, and I'd drink it and it'd kill me. No, not in a million years. I wouldn't even sit on a table with him in case he dusted it with something. That's how dangerous we're talking about. You know, as I said, he made the crazy look like any of your bad men, you know, look like amateur street fighters. This guy was deadly.
You were never tempted to go and see him inside?
Not really, no. In retrospect, I'm quite surprised because I'm interested in people. I'd written a book about this guy. It would have been interesting to have talked to him, to have met him, asked him questions about things, I don't know, were unresolved. But I just thought it would have been madness, because one would have had a cup of tea, one would have had some sort of, I suppose you could have turned it down, but that would have been impolite, not a man to be impolite to. I just thought, no, this is not a good idea, go and have a cup of tea with him.
If you were doing something naughty in prison, like carrying a weapon or smuggling something in, they say, well, what's the risk of it? If it's very high risk, they say, well, it's about as risky as having Graham Young on your tea boat. You know, the guy was that bad that, you know, in prison, you know, the God Squad would always meet up with the most horrific killers, like the Bradys of this world and all that. But no one invited Graham Young to the Vicar's Tea Party. You know, even they weren't that crazy. The guy was that dangerous. Even prison officers didn't feel safe with him.
Everyone was too scared to approach the convicted poisoner. He became completely isolated. On the 1st of August 1990, Graham Young was found dead in his cell, aged just 42. The official cause of death was heart failure, but he had no history of a heart condition. And the mystery of Graham Young's death, murder, suicide, natural causes?
Some prison officers said that, you know, prisoners had him and done him. And there's a possibility that prisoners thought, well, we don't feel safe with anyone, let's take away this threat, because they'd live with it for years. But having said that, there was prisoners who said prison officers done it, because they had to live with this guy, and they weren't safe either. He could have doctored their teas.
I think he may have committed suicide. He was somebody who recognised that the rest of his life was going to be spent behind bars, and I felt took the ultimate form of power and control over his own life by gaining access to whatever poison he would be able to find, poisons that he would be able to kill himself with.
Prior to his death, Graham Young had been approached by cosmetic companies keen to utilise his understanding of chemicals to enhance their products. So, just how different could his life have been had he placed his knowledge of poison to more productive use?
I mean, there was people manufacturing these herbal lipsticks and all that. Right in Young's, you know, what keeps the colour on better? What, you know, what plants would I use? So, you know, in his own way, he was the kiddie on the block when it came to the poison game. The only thing was, he was totally immoral.
Well, at one point, he applied for a job with the Police Forensic Science Laboratory. He probably could have been a very good force for scientific investigation on the right side of the law. But no, he had this deadness to normal human interaction. He had no compunction, no remorse, no guilt about inflicting terrible pain, and in some cases, death.
I suppose it makes you think perhaps a little bit more cautiously about individuals, and you learn a little more about life, and the fact that somebody isn't necessarily all they seem, and if they're quiet and relatively harmless, perhaps they're not.
The accounts that I've heard from the people who met Graham Young and have studied his story suggest to me that although he may have been highly intelligent, he was at heart completely insane. Who knows what he could have achieved if his talents for toxicology had been recognised and developed. What we do know is that he placed no value on human life and saw his existence as one big experiment.